Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Haroon Maarouf, a journalist at Voice of America. His views reflect his own opinions and not those of Voice of America.
During this episode, we talked about what Al-Shabaab has been up to since the Westgate Mall attack in Kenya, background on Al-Shabaab's leader Ahmed Umar, and how he compares with its former one, Ahmed Abdi Gudani, the state of foreign fighters in Somalia, and the status of the Islamic State's efforts inside of Somalia.
After the interview, we'll have a new hashtag social media segment covering postings from October 24th through November 1st. And also, I want to thank the Patreon supporters of the podcast. And if you guys haven't seen, we released some bonus content a couple days ago, and we'll be putting out some more in the coming days. So make sure you check out the Patreon page. There's a link in the show notes so you can get access to that. Now here's Aaron's interview with Haroon Maarouf.
The topic of jihadism in Somalia cannot be more timely in light of the recent pledge of bayah by Abdulkader Mutin to the Islamic State's Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Haroon and I, we had actually planned to do this podcast on this date a few weeks ago beforehand, so this is all quite prescient. That said, we have Haroon Maarouf on the show today to take us through that and many other issues. Thanks for coming onto the show.
Thanks, Aaron.
So one of the, things that's been going on in the jihadi world over the last few years that's sucked up a lot of the energy and what people are covering is Syria. But before that, in many ways, everybody was focused on Al-Shabaab, especially in the West. And one of the larger scale events that many people likely remember was when Al-Shabaab did the attack in Kenya on the Westgate Mall in September 2013. So I was wondering maybe if you could talk a little bit about what Al-Shabaab has been up to in Somalia, Kenya, and anywhere else in the Horn since that attack.
Well, thanks again for having me today. Westgate has been the most high-profile attack Al-Shabaab has launched in and outside Somalia. It has given Al-Shabaab legitimacy in the eyes of the global jihadism that it's capable of carrying out such deadly, high-profile, well-coordinated attacks. And Al-Shabaab actually has been using Westgate attack as a propaganda tool inside Somalia. They have actually launched campaigns, media outreach to the countryside, to the grassroots level, trying to capitalize on it and to inspire more people to join in their ranks. They have actually promised Al-Shabaab that we might never know the truth about what happened in Westgate, how it was planned, how many people participated in that attack. And so far, we don't know a lot about exactly what happened in Westgate. We don't know the number of people who participated. We don't know how it was planned. And we don't know whether some of the attackers may have escaped and returned to Somalia safely. So that was very successful for Al-Shabaab. But also, on the other hand, if you remember when just before Westgate attack took place, Al-Shabaab was having internal power struggle between the leadership. That also worked in favor of the former leader, Ahmed Abdi Gudani, who got rid of some of his most critical figures within the group. And then he started restructuring the group. There was a young crop of leaders who emerged, who were trained in Somalia, a hardcore group of loyalists who became in charge of the army and some of the political offices. On the other hand, they had some setbacks. They had success in the front line and in carrying out these attacks, but also there were some setbacks. They lost more than 10 major cities in Somalia, including their temporary headquarters, Brawe. And for that reason, they lost a lot of finance. lot of revenue. They lost a lot of territory to the Somali government and African Union troops. So they restructured and reloaded their guerrilla attack too. So it was, they had some successes in the front lines in carrying out attacks, but also they had some setbacks. In terms of setbacks, if I may continue, the month after the Westgate attack, they lost their top bomb maker. In early last year, 2014, they lost the head of the health department. They lost the Amir, the overall leader of the group, Ahmed Abdi Godani. They also lost three other key figures, including the alleged mastermind of the Westgate attack. So it was, they had ups and downs.
Yeah, we've definitely seen that over time with the history of Al-Shabaab in terms of the ebb and flow of whether they seem to be coming back or whether they seem to be losing on the battlefield and not doing too well. Maybe we can now get into more about Al-Shabaab's prior leader, Godani, who was killed in September 2014. Can you maybe talk about the background of who their new leader is after him, Ahmed Umar, and how is his leadership continued what Godani was doing previously, and how has he potentially been different or changed? And what's the reason for Al-Shabaab's continued support of Ayman al-Zawahiri and al-Qaeda in light of all of this?
Ahmed Umar Abu Ubaidah, or Ahmed Diriya as he is known locally, was a trusted loyalist of Godani. He was a very key ally of his inner circle, but he was not new to the jihadist world in Somalia. He was a jihadist more than 20 years. He was trained in one of the camps in Lower Juba region. That's an area close to the border with Kenya. You know, in mid-1990s, Ethiopia sent troops into Somalia. They attacked and dismantled some of the bases of Al-Ittihad, Al-Islam, that is the parent organization of current, today's Al-Shabaab. When Al-Ittihad was disbanded, some of its members continued jihad. Some of them traveled to Afghanistan. Some of them, they just started lying down low. Some of them, they completely changed direction and they went into education centers, business. Ahmed Umar Abu Ubaidah was one of them. He started a school in Kismayo and he worked his way up. He was teaching and he was the principal of thousands of a school where thousands of children, kids were studying Islamic studies and other education. But when in 2006, the Islamic courts came back, and among the Islamic courts, there were this jihadist wing, Al-Shabaab. Ahmed Umar came back again. He re-emerged, and then he rejoined Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab, of course, is the outgrowth of Al-Ittihad, the organization that he belonged to himself. So he's not new to the jihadism world. When he worked his way up, and he showed really some hard work. He became the wali or the governor of two key regions in southwestern Somalia, Bay and Bakool region. These are the two regions that we can say Al-Shabaab achieved maximum success in recruiting and attaining the support of the localists. These are the regions which produced most of those in the ranks, the rank and file of Al-Shabaab in terms of the front lines, in terms of the junior officials. And Ahmed Umar Abu Ubaidah was the governor and he achieved that. So he was rewarded for that and he was promoted as the senior advisor of Godani. And just 2 months before Godani was killed on September 1st, 2014, Ahmed Umar Abu Ubaidah was promoted to the wali of to the governor of all governors. That means it's very powerful position in Al-Shabaab ranks. It's similar to the interior minister. He runs all the politics, all the outreach, the movement of the troops and the and their jabha. So he was very powerful. And then when Gudene died, still the power was in the hands of the Gudene camp, and they thought Ahmed Umar could continue that. Ahmed Umar, he's not like Gudene, people say. He's not very decisive like Gudene, but he's more approachable. He tried actually to bring together some of the dissenting voices and some of those already within the group. He had achieved that to some degree, but they say his weakness is that he's not very decisive. When an opportunity rises, he doesn't take that swift decision that Gudene was capable of, that element of surprise. But on the other hand, he tried to bring together all the factions within Al-Shabaab, and he's very communicative, they say. He communicates well with his officials, and so far, some people would say he did okay. Some people thought that Al-Shabaab will die with Gudene, but they didn't. And they actually have achieved some spectacular attacks, not only in Mogadishu, but also in the neighboring countries. We have seen the attack on the Garissa University, the increased attacks in Kenya, increased attacks in the front lines, the daring attacks to take on military barracks in Somalia, attacking AMISOM troops, AU troops, as well as Somali troops. So he has achieved some considerable success in terms of maintaining what Gudene has already done.
And in terms of the continued support and relationship with Al-Qaeda and Ayman al-Zawahiri?
That's very interesting. When he was appointed as a successor to Gudene, he immediately renewed the bay'ah, or the oath of allegiance, with Al-Qaeda. The interesting thing is that here we know that many of the Al-Shabaab leadership, the old guard, have been to Afghanistan and Pakistan. They have personal knowledge for some of the leadership in Al-Qaeda. There is that personal connection with Al-Qaeda leadership. But also some of the junior officials, they were being sent deliberately and systematically by Al-Shabaab over the years to Yemen with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, as well as to Afghanistan. So they continued their relations with Al-Qaeda. So you can say they have some personal connections. But also when it comes to Al-Qaeda has very long, deep roots in the Horn of Africa, in Somalia, in the coastal region in Kenya. They were there before even Al-Shabaab existed. They were there supporting Al-Ittihad. They sent really some high-profile figures, including Saif al-Adli, the Egyptian, who some say is the deputy leader of Al-Qaeda. Today, he's been to Somalia. Osama bin Laden sent a number of emissaries to Somalia. Al-Qaeda was present, and they were working with Al-Shabaab and previously with Al-Ittihad. So they have some deep-rooted links on the ground, and they continue to milk that, and that's mainly the basis for their presence in Somalia and for the link with Al-Shabaab. But when it comes also to possible split from Al-Qaeda, this is also very key. It's not only that personal connection with Al-Qaeda, it's also about power. You know, ISIS is a new organization, and some might say if Al-Shabaab leaders give allegiance to ISIS, some of them might find that's going to compromise their states and their leadership on the ground. But also Al-Shabaab has that local connection. They have had some setbacks. Whenever they have setback, whenever they are in a very difficult situation, they completely twisted the situation and they show local connection. They try to contact with the elders. They renew bay'ah with the local elders. They display themselves, portray themselves as a patriotic movement that is actually defending the country against neighboring states such as Kenya and Ethiopia. Both countries are not very popular in Somalia anyway. So they play to those issues and they exploit those issues and the grievances some Somalis may have against these countries. So they, Al-Shabaab, if they, some people would say that Al-Shabaab, if they really give allegiance to ISIS, they could lose whatever that is left in terms of exploiting these local grievances. And some people might view them as going too far. So that's probably why they were, the leadership especially, were very hesitant to quickly join up ISIS.
Yeah, definitely. Shifting a little bit over, do you still see foreign fighters coming to Somalia? Obviously, from around 2006 to 2009, there's a huge influx. Or are more of them now going to Syria instead, as we've seen with, say, the networks in Minneapolis, for example? And for those that have come and or have remained in Somalia, what has the role been inside of Al-Shabaab, especially after what happened with Omar Hamami and his friends who were purged by Al-Shabaab's leadership?
It's an interesting group. I would separate the foreign jihadists into two groups, the regional jihadists, and those are the jihadists who may have been coming from the West, United States, Europe, and the Middle East. We see increasing evidence of this group is going to join the ranks of ISIS at the moment. ISIS is attracting, they're doing something that's attracting these young jihadists to go from the West and join them. Not a lot of jihadists are going from the West Not a lot of young jihadists are leaving the West and are trying to join Al-Shabaab at the moment. We don't see that. It happened 5-6 years ago, maybe few hundred jihadists left the West to join Al-Shabaab. But the majority of foreign jihadists who joined Al-Shabaab are from the region. They are from Swahili-speaking countries. They are from Kenya, whether they are ethnic Somalis or other Kenyan ethnic communities from the coastal regions where there is a large Muslim population who had grievances with the Kenyan government, who had land disputes with other ethnic communities in Kenya, who felt that the government marginalized, sidelined it, and did not address their grievances for a long time. But also the coastal areas in Kenya, Tanzania, Mauritius, Zanzibar. This area is an area where Al-Qaeda was present long, long time ago. So Al-Shabaab recruitment in this area is only natural. You can say fairly that 70 to 80% of foreign jihadists with Al-Shabaab are from the region, from East Africa region. And the jihadists from the West, in particular, have struggled in operating alongside other Al-Shabaab figures. We have seen when the former leader of Al-Shabaab was alive, Gudane, they were targeted. Umar Hamami, the American jihadist was killed. A number of others were imprisoned. And this was the way of Al-Shabaab showing that they really don't trust many of these jihadists who are coming from the West. When they arrive in the country, they confiscate their possessions, they confiscate their passport. They don't allow them immediately to go and mingle with other fighters. They are kept in special camps, in special homes. And this was very difficult for young jihadists who, in their eyes, were looking for freedom, that they will be fighting alongside their brothers. It was very hard for them to take. So they found it very difficult to adapt and survive. Some of them were actually forced to flee the country. They were expelled by the hostile reception they received on the ground. But at the moment, whatever foreign jihadists who are left in Somalia, they are fighting in the military. They have been embedded in the Chabha, as they call within Al-Shabaab. Chabha is the military wing of Al-Shabaab. They are not in one group. They wanted at the beginning, this is one of the reasons that Umar Hamami had run in with the leadership of Al-Shabaab. He wanted to assemble and group and lead his own fighters or foreign jihadists, but Al-Shabaab was not allowing that. That does not happen again when it comes to jihadists who came from the West. They are being embedded in different groups. They are in the front lines fighting. Few of them are on social media trying to make a campaign to reach out to others. They are not very active. They are not very media savvy, like compared to ISIS, it non-existent. But the regional jihadists who are with Al-Shabaab, Al-Shabaab has really put them into use. They were mobilized. They were sent back to Kenya, a lot of them. And they have been carrying out deadly attacks in Kenya, in the coastal region, the attacks in Bekatoni, the attacks in Lamu, the attacks in Garissa and other places. These are being carried out primarily by regional jihadists who are either from Kenya or Tanzania, who speak the local Swahili language, who can easily mix with the locals, who can easily escape and disappear into the community and into the bush. And also fighting along this side group are a number of foreign jihadists. And that was a way of for Al-Shabaab really to get rid of them, get them away from the area around the leadership, because they simply did not trust them.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking of people they don't trust, is obviously the Islamic State. And as I alluded to in the beginning of the show, we saw Al-Shabaab's leader, Abdul Qadir Mu'min, in the Puntland region, pledge bayat to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi on behalf of himself and a group of followers. Can you maybe talk a little bit about who Abdul Qadir Mu'min is, and what is the Islamic State's presence in Somalia currently, and how is the Islamic State tried to sort of get itself in there, and the messaging it's pushed towards Al-Shabaab members to try and get them on board? And do you think it's possible that we might see more IS splinter factions from Al-Shabaab in the same way we've seen with, say, AQIM splinter factions? And there have been also recent purges of alleged IS sympathizers by Al-Shabaab. Do you think Shabaab is going to try and go to war now with Abdul Qadir Mu'min? I know there's a lot of questions, but you can go one by one.
Yeah, Abdul Qadir Mu'min is a Salafi ideologue. He is very well known in Somalia. He's not new to the jihadism world. He was probably, if not the first, one of the first Somali Salafi scholars to oppose the former regime, the military regime that ruled Somalia 21 years. That's the government of Siad Barre. He ran a mosque in Mogadishu. He was very vocal. He criticized what he saw, the unreligious military regime that ruled the country. And he was one of the few scholars who really dared to criticize that regime. And at that time, it was very, very rare for anybody in Somalia to attack and criticize the government, because that was going to lead Anybody who does that is going to lead to death or long-term imprisonment. It did not happen to him for some reason. He was detained several times, then released. So that has given him some stature, some base, and many Somali Salafi groups, they idolize him for that, for standing up to that regime, which they regarded as a communist regime that really misinterpreted the religion, that they advocated for any kind of measures to be removed from power. So he was that kind of scholar. He lived in the United Kingdom for a while because of the civil war in Somalia. But when the Islamic Courts Union reappeared in Somalia in 2005, he returned to the country and he became one of the bedrocks of the Islamic Courts movement. He was a member of the Shura Council, and later on when the Islamic Courts and Al-Shabaab split, he joined Al-Shabaab. He was one of those scholars who were giving them religious justifications, fatwas for Al-Shabaab. He was very vocal. He was not somebody who hid his face. He was putting himself out there, speaking, making the argument, the religious justification is for Al-Shabaab's war. So he has some strong support within Al-Shabaab. And this is why Al-Shabaab, when it wanted to make inroads and progress in that part of Somalia, the northeastern part of Somalia, Puntland, an area they were not very active in the past, he was one of the people they sent there. He is from that region, so he knows the area, he knows the people, and he made a foothold for them in that region, and they succeeded in fighting off attacks from the local forces, the Puntland forces. So it was a surprise to the leadership of Al-Shabaab that he announced it reportedly that he gave allegiance to ISIS. We don't know what caused it, but we know that for some time ISIS, directly or indirectly, have been trying to reach out to groups within Al-Shabaab. When they failed to convince the leadership to give allegiance, then they started contacting other groups, other individuals they thought will be sympathetic to their emergency and to their domination of global jihadism at the moment. Abdul Ghadir Mumin last week was reportedly gave allegiance. He has some significant fighters in the area, but he is also from the area. So it's very likely he will be there for a while. And in the south, where the majority of the Al-Shabaab leadership is present, we have seen some mini revolt, some members of the Jabha and the Da'wah departments of Al-Shabaab coming out and saying they really support ISIS. What we see now is growing support for ISIS. We can't say that ISIS is still present, but we can say there is an ISIS support in Somalia. I have heard one case of an individual who used to be a member of Al-Shabaab from that part of the country in Puntland, who may have traveled to an ISIS territory in Sirte in Libya. And I believe that individual has returned to the country at the moment. I don't know where he is, but he has returned to the country. Al-Shabaab leadership suspect that he is the one who instigated this mini revolt. A number of junior officials were detained. Some people said about 30 were detained. Some people are putting the number a little bit more than that. What we could see is that so far, we haven't seen any evidence of Al-Shabaab killing or executing the individuals who have expressed sympathy or support for ISIS. So far, they were detained. And this is not very uncommon. If you go back to the previous internal fighting, those differences between Gaddafi, the late leader of Al-Shabaab, and other members of the executive council has been running for years, and they held several meetings to convince them to come on board. They held several meetings to generate some mediation, to start some mediation between the groups. Although Gaddafi never gave in, he never compromised from his position, nonetheless, he reached out to his opponents, and that was a tactic to show to his supporters that he was ready, negotiation, that he was listening to the mediators, to the scholars. Although many people would say he was not actually listening, he was not good at listening, but at least it gave the projection, the perception that he was making an effort to reach out and to solve the dispute. This is exactly what we see now with regard to the emergence of the pro-ISIS elements within Al-Shabaab. They are detaining them, they are warning them, they are sending them telephone messages. They're saying you will be attacked, you will be detained, you should stop this. They issued an internal memo which actually said that they are not going to tolerate any other group that creates discord, that expresses support or causes the group to split again. So that's part of the strategy at the moment, but I'm not going to rule out that these individuals, that they could be attacked in the long run. But Al-Shabaab, at the moment, the leadership, they're taking their time, and they are giving these groups all the time they need to actually feel that supporting ISIS might not serve their interest if they want to stay with Al-Shabaab.
It's interesting that we might sort of see a broader conflict in the Somali arena in the same way we've already seen some of this internal fighting in Syria, Afghanistan, Libya, and the like. So just to conclude now in terms of the last question and looking forward, where do you see the trajectory of both Al-Shabaab in Somalia and the region and for ISIS's potential future prospects inside of Somalia going forward?
I'll start with the ISIS question. ISIS probably will have more sympathizers, more support, more groups sympathetic to their cause in Somalia. Al-Shabaab, as we have seen before, they coexisted alongside the ICU, the Islamic Courts Union. But when they came to a stage when they were in a position to make a decisive position to stand out, to separate themselves from the rest, because they had the power and the opportunity and the local support at the time because of the presence of the Ethiopian troops, they did that. They took that decisive action to stand alone. Also, you have seen in the past the emergence of Hizbul Islam, and Hizbul Islam coexisted as well with Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab, they were very patient. They showed that they can tolerate the presence of another Islamist group among them at the beginning. But that did not last long. When they were in a position to take over Hizbul Islam, to dismantle them, to neutralize them, they exactly did that. So the possibility here is that Al-Shabaab could do the same to these emerging groups who are supportive of ISIS. It's very likely they will play the patience game again, and they will give them time. And when there is a time that they can absorb them, back into the group, they will do so. That also leads us to the question of resilience of Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab is very resilient. They like to be underestimated, actually. And they have not been stretched fully so far by the African Union troops and the Somali government. They still control vast territory in the countryside. There is one region in Somalia where they control the entire region. That is the lower Juba. That is the middle Juba region. But they also control most of the territory in lower Juba and other regions. And lower Juba, middle Juba, and Gedo regions, these are three regions that are very close to Kenya. This is the spiritual home of Somali jihadists. This is where Al-Ittihad was formed. This is an area which has vast hinterland, a lot of forests. They can just disappear into the forest, regroup, re-emerge. It will be very difficult for the African Union troops and the Somali government to go after them and eliminate them completely. That is not going to happen anytime soon. And Al-Shabaab is not at that point yet. They have not been driven. Their back's not on the wall. They still control an areas that are very close to Mogadishu, and they're still sneaking into Mogadishu. So they still have that power. They still have that resilience. That doesn't mean that their brutal tactics will always keep the support of the localists. That will always be a challenge to them. And it's fair to say that they lost a very large number of people, the support of very large number of people because of their tactics. But in the long run, Al-Shabaab has created an affiliate group in Kenya. They sent a lot of men into Kenya. They are running freely. These regions that are very close to the border with Kenya. And I see them going back there if they are pushed from the rest of the country, regrouping, coming back in one way or another.
Well, thanks for coming onto the show today, Haroon, and laying everything out for us in terms of the state of Shabaab and sort of the entrance of IS into the arena as well.
Thank you. Thanks, Aaron.
This episode's hashtag social media segment will cover postings from October 24th through November 1st.
During that time span, 5 foreign fighters were announced killed by various groups in Syria, while 13 foreign fighters were announced killed by the Islamic State in Iraq. Also during that time period, AQAP announced 7 military attacks inside of Yemen.
On October 24th, Wilayat Tarablus of the Islamic State shows off its carpentry work in Sirte, Libya.
Also on the 24th, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State plants the winter crops in Tel Abta, Iraq.
On the 24th as well, Wilayat al-Damashq of the Islamic State destroys a Sufi shrine in al-Ajat area in Dara district, Syria.
On October 26th, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State restores sidewalks in the al-Kirwan district.
On the 26th as well, Wilayat Dijla of the Islamic State starts building a bridge over the river in al-Zab district.
On October 26th as well, Wilayat Halab of the Islamic State builds a new market in the city of Tadif, Syria.
And also on the 26th, Wilayat Raqqa of the Islamic State opens a new health center in the village of Al-Dibsi.
On October 27th, AQAP blowed up a Sufi shrine in Al-Mukalla, Yemen.
On October 28th, Jabhat al-Nusra distributes Dawah literature to residents in the Al-Badiyah region of Syria.
Also on the 28th, Wilayat al-Fallujah of the Islamic State builds a new media point in the al-Amariya region.
Also on the 28th, Wilayat al-Khair of the Islamic State shows off its dialysis center in the city of al-Mayadin, Syria.
Also on the 28th, Wilayat al-Raqqa of the Islamic State shows off its car dealership in al-Raqqa city.
And finally, on October 29th, Wilayat al-Janub of the Islamic State builds a new media point in al-Zawba, Iraq. If you have any feedback about the show, you can email podcast@jihadology.net or find us on Twitter where we are @jihadpod. If you're a fan of the program, please consider becoming a patron of the show. You can check out the Patreon link that's in the show notes. Thanks to everyone who's already signed up to support the show on Patreon, in particular, Hakon Jar. We really appreciate the support from all the patrons. One of the benefits of becoming a supporter of the show is you'll get access to bonus content that is only available to our patrons, and we've recently started putting some of that out. The first piece was a bonus interview me and Aaron did where he's talking about a recent conference in Paris, and then we have some more stuff coming out in the next couple days. It'll be about a conference he went to in Rome, as well as some behind-the-scenes stuff and some additional content related to the show that we're going to be rolling out. So if you're interested in that, definitely check out the Patreon page and help support the podcast. As always, you can find the show in iTunes and Stitcher, and if you use one of those platforms to listen to the podcast, please consider taking a moment to rate and review the podcast there, which will help more people find the show.
Thanks everyone for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thanks to Haroon for coming onto the show and sharing his expertise with us. Also, thanks to the podmaster Carl Moran for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly. Until next time, I'm out.